2 Kings 4, we still lack 2 Kings 4, 42 through 44. And then, Lord willing, we'll get into 2 Kings 5. That is more of a sustained account that can all be read together. But let's read verses 42 through 44. Now a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and fresh ears of grain in his sack. And he said, "Give them to the people that they may eat." His attendant said, What shall I set this before 100 men?" And he said, "Give them to the people that they may eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. Okay, we probably know how small this amount was by the fact that this man from Baal Shalisha brought Elisha this bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and fresh ears of grain in his sack. It all sounds like, you know, this is one sack, and I don't know how large, but it doesn't seem like it was an enormous amount, because when 100 men are there and he needs to feed them, the man said, "What? Am I going to sit this before 100 men?" And the prophet says, "Yes, they will eat and have some left over." Notice he says, "Thus says the Lord," in verse 3, and in verse 43, "For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." And then in verse 44, he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. So thus says the Lord, and then everything happens according to the word of the Lord. Now, let's say a couple of words about this. First of all, bread of the first fruits. To whom was that generally taken? Bread of the first fruits.
The priest
was taken to the priest. But instead, in this particular case, it's taken to the prophet, Elisha. It's taken to the prophet instead of the priest. Now, what does that tell us? Maybe it tells us, like we've already seen about Rehoboam, that the priesthood is corrupt. The priesthood is corrupt, as we saw in 1 Kings chapter 12, as they appointed priests of all the people. And so now he is bringing the first fruits, not to the priest, but to the prophets. And some have made the suggestion as well that the prophet was a kind of temple. And in a certain sense, that may be correct. One writer kept pushing this point about Elisha, that in a way, he is the temple of God, or as close as they have to this in the north, where, of course, the temple is in Jerusalem. Now, I am guessing you're going to know the answer to what I'm about to ask. What miracle of Jesus does this remind you of?
Walking on the water.
Okay. Yes. The very fact that everybody laughs, in this case, is a good sign. Because it's not the one that it is. But the only miracle recorded in all four Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000. And so you see the same kind of things that you see here. And of course, we saw this same kind of miracle in the time of Elijah, where the oil and meal was prolonged, or the kept being replenished, maybe we could say. 1 Kings 17, verses 8 through 16. And so Elijah does miracles that Elijah does miracles that Elisha imitates, and ultimately Jesus will supersede and do even greater ones, feeding 5,000 with even less food and having some left over. Anything else right there, though? Anything else? Micah?
It strikes me that as we look at so many of Elisha's miracles, that this is among the few where it says, "Thus says the Lord." I don't know if there's much to make of that, where he has an idea of bringing flour. It doesn't say, "Thus says the Lord, bring flour for that." And same with the widow's oil and so on. I didn't know if there's anything to that or not.
Well, it may not be stated every time. I think we'll see that it does appear in this next miracle by something that's said in the midst of it. But we know that he's not doing this on his own power or his own authority. He doesn't have the ability to multiply the oil. He doesn't have the ability to raise the child from the dead. And so I would say in that respect, even though it is not specifically stated, we know he's only doing this according to the Lord's will. And the Lord is the power behind it. Okay? What other things do you have right there? Any other questions? I'm going to try to start out reading this, and if my voice gives out, I may call on you all at any point, okay? So just be ready. I love this. I hope I can read it well, in a sense, to help us fully appreciate it. This is one of the places in the Old Testament that I do remember being preached on quite a bit when I was growing up. That's not necessarily true about a lot of these Old Testament passages, particularly from 1st and 2nd Kings. But this one, yes. Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel." Then the king of Aram said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "And now as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy." It came about when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? But consider now and see how he is seeking a quarrel against me." It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king, saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was furious and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. And are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, My master, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then, when he says to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. When he returned to the man of God with all his company and came and stood before him, he said, Behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now. But he said, As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And Naaman said, If not, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth, for your servant will no more offer burnt offerings, nor will he sacrifice to other gods but the Lord. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. He said to him, Go in peace. So he departed from him some distance. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, Behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Aramean by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. But Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him and said, Is all well? And he said, All is well. My master has sent me, saying, Behold, just now 2 young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them 1 talent of silver and 2 changes of clothes. And Naaman said, Be pleased to take 2 talents. And he urged him. And he bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of clothes and gave them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them before him. When he came to the hill, he took them from his hand and deposited them in his house. And he sent the men away, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said to him, Where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, Your servant went nowhere. Then he said to him, Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet me? Is it time to receive money and to receive clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cleave to you and your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. Naaman was a captain of the army of the king of Aram and was a great man. Now, I found this out, and I have to admit, I did not know this at all. Josephus and a Targum, which is an Aramaic paraphrase, which they might write notes in there, and archaeologists have discovered these paraphrases, and sometimes it is notes and commentary written in it. It suggests that Naaman was that soldier in 1 Kings 22 who shot that arrow at random and it hit Ahab. Now, I'm not saying that's gospel proof. I'm just saying that some throughout history have speculated that, and I don't know. Is that what it means that by him the Lord had given victory to Aram? But it does show us, whenever this was, that God sometimes gives victory for pagans over his people to punish his people for their sin. And that's clearly said right there. He gave victory over Israel to Aaron. And all these good things said about him. He was a great man. He was highly respected. The Lord had given him victory, but he was a leper. Now, I will say this. When we read the word leprosy, we are kind of struck with horror that, you know, this is that debilitating disease that we see today that's called leprosy, where and there's actually a leper colony in Louisiana. And I believe it, there's also one in Hawaii. But it's much worse in places like India. And what leprosy does, it doesn't itself cause parts of the body to fall off, but it causes you to lose all sensitivity to pain. And therefore, like, you could cut it and you don't know it's hurt. And so you end up losing fingers and toes and things of that nature. But it can be very debilitating. But in the Bible, the disease is not always as severe as that. Now you say, how do I know that? Just by the thing said in Leviticus 13 and 14 about the symptoms of that disease, they are much lighter. It would be skin problems and skin diseases, not necessarily full-blown leprosy. Now, even saying that, I'm sure there were different stages of it. And whatever this was, it seems to have been, to some degree, debilitating to Naaman. And he is desperately wanting a cure. It is interesting, Naaman has an Israelite girl as a slave. He has an Israelite girl as a slave. And this slave apparently was treated well enough by him that she respects him and wishes Naaman well. And she says to Naaman's wife, "Oh, I wish my master were in the land of Israel, because there's a prophet there who could cure him of his leprosy." Now, Naaman is one who desperately wants to be cured. Naaman is quick to tell the king about this. And the king sends a letter to the king of Israel and sends a present along with him and says, "This is Naaman. Would you cure him of his leprosy?" Now, there are parallels to this from the ancient world. One king hears that another nation has a treatment for something, he might send some of his people there. You particularly see that in the ancient world with the land of Egypt and with Egyptian physicians. And he sends a pretty large present. He sends 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. Now, to put that in perspective, and to show you that is a pretty big gift, you remember that Omri was the one who made Samaria capital in 1 Kings 16. And you know what he bought Samaria for? 2 talents of silver. 1 Kings 16, 24. 2 talents of silver, but now 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 changes of clothes. I mean, he's willing to pay big money for his servant to be healed. And says, "Here's Naaman, can you cure him of his leprosy?" And the king tears his robe, says, "Am I God to kill and to make alive?" Now, couple of things interesting about that. First of all, there is, Aram and Israel are going to be at war all through this section. Aram and Israel at war. There is sufficient peace at this particular moment to send Naaman with a gift and say, can you cure him of his leprosy? But there is also sufficient trouble and sufficient tension between them as for the king of Israel to say, look, he's trying to start a quarrel with me. He's trying to start a fight with me by sending this man to say, cure him of his leprosy. Now think about his question. Am I God to kill and to make alive? The last chapter, we've seen God has the power to make alive, doesn't he? As he raised that boy from the dead. God has the power to do this. Does this mean he doesn't even know about Elisha? But go ahead, Miss.
I just had a question about, the first verse, it says, the Lord had given victory. In this verse, he says, am I God? So what Hebrew word is that God there?
Like, okay.
Say, am I the Lord? You know.
Like, yeah, the word Lord would be the word Yahweh, which is always used of Israel's God. So there's no question there. In verse 7, it is the word Elohim that is used. But he is speaking of the true God. He is speaking of the true God. And his question, his statement, am I God to kill and make alive? In Deuteronomy 32, verse 39, God speaks of his power to do both of these, to kill and to make alive. So God does have the power to do these particular things. He's acknowledging that the king is acknowledging, king of Israel acknowledges that he's powerless to deal with the situation, that only God can deal with this situation. And I think in that respect, he's right, but he doesn't seem to consider much the prophet Elisha. And Elisha says, you send him to me. So why did you torn your clothes? Send him to me and you'll know there's a prophet in Israel. Was that all your question then? Bob?
So I read this and wondered how Elisha found out so quickly, because Naaman was still there, and I don't know what distance there was between, you know, the king and him and things like that, but I found that interesting.
That is interesting. It is. I can't answer the question, but it is interesting observation. He apparently is much more aware of what goes on in the palace than Elijah does. Elijah's alienated. He seems to be on closer terms, but why doesn't the king think of sending Naaman to him from the beginning? You know, that doesn't seem to make sense. But remember, when we get to the next chapter too, the Lord reveals things to Elisha. Maybe the Lord reveals to him what's going on in this particular case. Micah?
Do we know which king of Israel this is?
No, not with certainty. I take it that this is Jehoram of 2 Kings chapter 3. The son of Ahab, the brother of Ahaziah. We don't know, though, with certainty what king of Israel it is or what king of Aram it is. They are not specifically mentioned. We just kind of say that because chronologically, a lot of the events of Elisha are recorded here in the time of Jehoram, but he lives till quite a ways after this. He won't die until 2 Kings 13. So it's possible that's not correct. But send him to me, Elisha said. He will know there's a prophet in Israel. And so here comes Naaman with his horses and chariots, and they drive right up to Elisha's house. And Elisha doesn't come out to greet him. He sends a messenger and says, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored and you'll be clean. And Naaman hears this and he is furious about this. Now, Look at verse 11. Naaman was furious and said, "Behold, I thought, surely he will come out to me." Now let me tell you the order, the word order of the Hebrew text here. The word order is that, see, I thought to me he would surely come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God. But the point is, the word to me is in a very emphatic position. He is thinking just of himself. He says, I thought he was going to come out and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. He'd watched those healings on late night TV. And that's what he was expecting. And he's not happy that he was told simply wash and be clean. But I think a great stroke of wisdom are his servants. The servants in this story who are not named. The girl servant mentioned in verse 3, she's not named. Verse 2 and 3, she's not named. These servants aren't named. They're mentioned in plural. After he said, well, if I wanted to wash, I could have gone and saved my own country in Abana, far apart. The river's better than the Jordan. And his servants turned to him and said, my master, if he told you to do something great, you would have done it. How much less when he tells you, go wash in the Jordan to be clean? Hey, if you would do something dramatic and something great when the man of God told you to do it, why not do something simple? Why not when he just tells you something really easily? And to Naaman's credit, that made sense to him. And so he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan. Now, this was the phrase, Mike, I was referring to earlier in your question. According to the word of the man of God. Now, it doesn't say according to the word of the Lord. But I think we are seeing that that is the case. Am I God to kill and make alive? The fact that he can cure a man of this skin disease is proof that it's from God. According to the word of the man of God, he went and dipped in the Jordan, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Couple of things about that passage. First of all, according to the word of the Lord is in a different order than we've usually seen it appear. The place it would usually appear would be, he dipped 7 times in the Jordan, he was cleansed according to the word of the Lord. Everything happened like you said. But here it's a little before that. If the word of the Lord always comes true, isn't it always wise to obey the word of the Lord? And here he goes down and dips in the Jordan just exactly what the man of God told him to do. If the word of the Lord always comes true, and we need to listen to it. Sometimes it simply records the fulfillment of a promise, but here it apparently motivated him to do what the prophet told him to do. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. Now, I read this statement, and in some context, I would have disagreed with it. But it was very evident in the context what this man was saying. One of the commentaries I looked at used this passage, and he made some very interesting arguments about baptism. And that might be why many of us heard this passage preached on when we were growing up. And he made this statement. He talked about how baptism is the place where God washes us clean. And sometimes we object because we'd rather do something great. But how much less when he tells us to do something simple? But this is what he said. He said, all baptism is infant baptism. Now, what he meant by that wasn't that we're baptizing someone who doesn't know right or wrong. What he meant by that in context was, in a sense, like his flesh is made like a little child. We are innocent and clean, like a newborn child. And that is true. In a certain sense, all baptism, and you have to be careful. If you're listening to this tape, be careful. But all baptism is infant baptism in that sense. And I thought that was a pretty good observation. The writer made a pretty powerful statement about baptism in the midst of this. What are your ideas on those first 14 verses? What are your comments? Anissa?
It's interesting that he had leprosy, and it doesn't seem like he was, like in the New Testament, all the lepers that we read about, you know, they have to be outside the city. They're unclean. But he seems to be still part of the army or whatever, and still, you know, he doesn't seem to be exile or whatever.
Okay, that is a very good observation. What would be a difference between him and most of the other lepers we're reading in the Bible?
He's not an Israelite.
Yeah, he's not an Israelite. Yeah. In Israel, they dwelt without the camp in Leviticus 13 and 14. You're going to have a leper, and we're going to have a leper, four lepers in the next couple of weeks who dwell outside the city. But apparently, not all these type things were observed in other lands. This would have been something that would have made Moses' instructions unique. One of the similarities, though, I did see and think about from this passage in Leviticus 14, that at the end of the person being pronounced clean from leprosy, they sprinkled him seven times. Sprinkled him seven times. That's Leviticus 14, verse 7. Leviticus 14, verses 7 through 9. And here, he dips seven times. And I believe the Septuagint word, I think this is right, is the word baptizo. I have to look that up, but I didn't look that back up. But I think that is the word here. What else do you see?
Which part did you think was baptism?
I think it's to dip seven times. He dipped seven times. I believe. I will try to let you know that. By the way, I know this is awkward. This is awkward placement. But I forgot it all week, and I'm going to say it right now. When I was in a meeting in Wisconsin, Rob Anison was there three nights, and he said to tell y'all hello. And I've been meaning to tell everybody hello, so pass that along to everybody else too. But he said he and Michelle said to tell you all hello. And but anyway, any other questions on this section?
I don't know about a question, but it's just, I was thinking about how he listened to his servant. I think kind of goes back to what you were saying about the Israelite girl. Like, he must have been a favorable master. You see that he doesn't, like, his reaction first to, like, Elisha not coming out to talk to him, you think, wow, pride's going to get in the way.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, being a commander, he must have been a confident man.
Yeah.
Expected certain treatment.
Yeah.
But not a man that was prideful if he's going to listen to these servants.
Yes, yes. And really, a couple of people who are heroes in the story are not even named. Mm-hmm. You know, and how much is that true in church history? You can look back in church history and there'd be names that would be well known to people who study the subject. But the progress of Christianity has always depended on many people whose names would never be remembered by history. And it was true for God's cause then. But you make a good point there. You make a good point, exactly, Tiffany, that he's willing to listen to this, and he listens to the servant, and he says, well, that's right. That's a pretty good point. His servants knew, too, they could approach him. Now, I tell you, right at the heart of some of the most important passages in this text, I think is the statement in verse 8, send him to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. That's a really important statement. And this is also a lesson to Israel and the king. There is a prophet in Israel. But also the statement in verse 15 is very important. He returned with all his company, and he came and stood before him and said, behold, now I know there's no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now. Now he's convinced, not just that there's a prophet in Israel, but that Israel's God is the God. Now, I'm not going to ask you to answer this right now. Keep this in mind. Maybe write something down. We'll come back to it before we end today, Lord willing. How many times do we see people who are Gentiles exercising that kind of faith in the Old Testament? Just think about it. Who are some Gentiles that we see exercising that kind of faith? He says, I know there's no God in all the earth but in Israel. And he said, please take this present from your servant. And Elisha said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And it says, he urged him to take it. But he refused. He vows by the Lord, I'm not going to take it. When Naaman is begging and pleading with him, he doesn't take it. He says, I will not take it. He refused. There's a statement in 3 John, verse 8. 3 John, as it's encouraging hospitality to those who go out and preach God's truth. The text says in verse 8, we ought to support such men. Okay, well, first it's verse 7. It's 3 John verse 7. They went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. John is saying, we need to receive these people who go out preaching in his name. We need to do it because they went out. They went out preaching and they did not accept anything from the Gentiles. They didn't accept anything from them. Take nothing from them. And Elisha said, Naaman has all this wealth that he's brought. He says, I'm not going to take anything from you. He wants them to learn a lesson about Israel's God. He doesn't want to be personally enriched by this. After all, he knows he has a God who is able to provide. He will not take anything from Naaman, but he will give him something. He gives him 2 mules loads of earth that they may carry this back to the land of Aram to make a place where the Lord is worshipped. Often these they thought that if we take dirt from this land and bring it to our own land, this land where is the Lord's land, and we will be specially blessed and it's especially holy. And he says, I'm not going to offer burnt offerings. I'm not going to offer sacrifices to any other gods. But he does pray. He says, please forgive me when I have to accompany my master and he bows down before his God and he leans on my arm and I have to, and I bow down with him. Please accept that. I don't think the idea is that he's going to worship this God because he just stated in verse 17, I'm not going to offer burnt offerings and sacrifices to other gods, but please forgive me when I have to accompany him in the house of that God of Rimmon, who was much like the god Baal. And Elisha said, go in peace. But Gehazi says, Elisha's been too easy on him. And look at his vow. This is not really vow worthy, what he says. But he says in verse 20, as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. Elisha said, as the Lord lives, I'm going to take nothing from you. Gehazi says, as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and take something. So much of the vocabulary is the same. And Gehazi's running, and Naaman sees somebody running, and he looks back, and he stops the chariot, and he gets out, and he says, is all well? Now, we've seen that question before, didn't we? We saw that question Sunday. Is all well? Is there peace? And he said, is all well? And he says, yes, all is well. But said there was two young men, sons of the prophets, who just came to us. And we're asking for a talent of silver and two changes of garments. And Naaman says, take two talents of silver and two changes of clothes. And so he urged him. Look at verse 23. He urged him. That same word was used in verse 16. He urged Elisha, and Elisha didn't take it. He urged Gehazi, and he takes it. And so he comes, and he takes it, and he deposits it. Naaman has some men to help him carry it, and then he sends the men away, and Gehazi takes these things and puts it in his house. And what does that remind you of right there? Who put something in his house like that, the Old Testament?
Achan,
yeah. Achan. And remember what Achan took? Gold, silver. It's some gold, some silver, and a beautiful mantle from Shinar, a garment. And that is what he brought. That's what Naaman brought in verse 5. Silver, gold, and 10 changes of clothes. The silver and the changes of garments are mentioned. The gold isn't mentioned, but in a way, this is a reenactment of Achan's sin. And Elisha, he comes in for Elisha. Elisha says, well, where have you been, Gehazi? I said, I haven't been anywhere. He says, was not my heart with you when you turned aside and went after me? He wanted something that Naaman had to offer, and he's going to get it. He says, the leprosy of Naaman is going to cleave to you and your descendants forever. And when Gehazi goes out, he is leprous, as white as snow. I do want to say, let me look at verse 26, and we'll make a point there. Is it time for you to receive money and clothes, olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Some of those things haven't been mentioned in the context, have they? Olive groves and things. But the point is, in 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 18, these would be things the king of Israel will take from the people. And he is stating that as prophets, we're not going to be like these men. And we're not simply going to use our miraculous power the Lord's given us to enrich ourselves. It's not time for you to take these things. We want these people to know the greatness of our God. Tim, you had a question.
I was going to say, all of the kind of storytelling and, you know, manipulation makes me think of kind of Ananias and Sapphira.
That's true. Yeah, we have a little Ananias and Sapphira, which there are connections between Achan and Ananias and Sapphira as well. But you're right. I mean, he's concocting this story. He's making up this lie in order to get this personal enrichment. And it's really amazing, and we have to watch ourselves in this regard. It is amazing, though, that he could be around Elisha, that he could see these great wonders he did, it doesn't help shape his character. He's still willing to lie for personal wealth, knowing in a couple of chapters the Arameans are going to leave all their supplies behind and feed the whole city of Samaria. I mean, they're going to, God can turn everything they have over to him if he wants to. He serves a God who has got infinite resources available to him, and he doesn't need to try to use these miracles in a way to enrich himself. But it's a good point. Anything more, Tim, that you want to say on that? Well, what else? What other thoughts do you all have, Micah?
It's not, I was trying to look to see, and it doesn't seem to be the exact same language, but you can sort of see perhaps similarities between Gehazi in verse 20. Look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian with Jonah, who resents the Lord for relenting and essentially sparing other Gentiles.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's the same kind of motivation or same kind of of attitudes between them, but my mind went
there. We should take advantage of this from a Gentile. Yes. Okay, that leads us into what we said before. Where are some cases that we see in the Old Testament, Gentiles who express the kind of faith that Naaman did here? Who would be some examples of that?
Rahab
is clearly an example in Joshua 2, Joshua 6. Already, Micah has mentioned the people of Nineveh who repented at the preaching of Jonah in Jonah 3. Who else?
Daniel 3 and Daniel 6, you can see.
Okay. The kings at the end are going to make decrees about Israel's gods. I don't know if they become as full-fledged believers as a Rahab, but Daniel 3, Daniel 6, they do make decrees that Nebuchadnezzar and Darius the Mede make decrees about Israel's God. Who was Moses' father-in-law? Jethro or Reuel? In Exodus 18, he exercises this kind of faith. Melchizedek, that we talked about last night in Psalm 110, is another example of that. And there are others that may not be full-fledged converts or anything, but you got to, okay, Tim.
So the other thing I think about is the wise men that come to visit Jesus.
Okay, in the New Testament, in Matthew 2, you have that, as well as in Matthew 8, where you have the centurion who is a Gentile, and he says, I know you can just say the word and my servant will be healed. But you have people like 1 Kings 5, like Hiram, the king of Tyre, Hiram, king of Tyre, and in that particular case, he helped Solomon build the temple. He speaks about the greatness of God. So here are cases these people are sharing their knowledge of God with those around them, and hopefully till all the earth follows this God. Thank you. And Lord willing, Bob will be teaching on some.